This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Doucet Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Enjoy the show.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. Earlier this month, the House Criminal Justice Committee unanimously approved a bill that seemed to ease up on an unpopular group of people, sex offenders. The committee voted to ban towns from imposing residency restrictions on this group, ordinances that specify where they can live and where they can't. Courts have struck down several of these laws in New Hampshire already, with opponents arguing they don't improve safety, instead driving perpetrators underground and out of sight. But anything that appears to favor sex offenders is a tough sell politically. The full House tabled the measure by a wide margin, with one member calling it preposterous. And that's a sentiment reflected nationally, with several states recently tightening up on where these convicts can live and expanding their use of sex offender registries. It's a trend that reflects both public disgust with sex crimes, especially against children, and distrust that sex offenders can truly be rehabilitated. Today in The Exchange, what should our policy be towards sex offenders once they're released from prison? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. With me in studio for the hour is Jill Rocky. She's executive director at the Crisis Center of Central New Hampshire and a former detective sergeant with the New Hampshire State Police. And Jill Rocky, it's nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Joining us by phone is David Finkelhor, director of the Crimes Against Children Research Center and a professor of sociology at UNH. David Finkelhor, welcome back. Good to have you.
Nice to be here.
And joining us for a few moments now is Catherine Prudhomme O'Brien. She's a first-term Republican state representative from Derry. And Representative Prudhomme O'Brien, it's good to have you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, and I want to turn to you first, Representative Prudhomme O'Brien. You were opposed to this bill from the House committee, as were many of your colleagues. Why do you think residency requirements should be allowed by towns?
I think they should be allowed for numerous reasons. One of them is when you think about the size of our house with 400 members, why is that? It's because our founding fathers here in New Hampshire wanted local control. They wanted the representatives to be heard, and I at the state level. I think that towns should be allowed to make these decisions for themselves.
Do they have residency restrictions or requirements in your town, Representative Prudhomme O'Brien?
Not at this time, no.
So this, for you, was largely a matter of local control. The state shouldn't be telling towns how to do their business in this way.
That's not my only reason for this, but yeah.
What was
also,
the
when that came out of committee, I just want to say I know of at least one member who has changed his mind, and that would not have come out of committee unanimously had that been the case at the time.
Beyond local control, what were some of the reasons that you had for opposing this?
All right, if you just go on some websites of sex offender support groups, you'll find that New Hampshire is a destination state, that they discuss among themselves what state they'll move to when they get out of prison, or the parents of these people, or their family members, what state they want to move to and live in when they get out of prison. And New Hampshire is on that list, whether we like it or not.
How so? Can you give us a little more there? Because I'm not familiar with that.
Okay, I'll just tell you one thing I read anecdotally, and that was, my son is going to be leaving prison, and I would like to know what states don't have sex offender residency restrictions, and New Hampshire was on that list. And then the people started to talk among themselves about what would be better, Vermont or New Hampshire. Vermont, they said, was too boring. That was one comment. So, I mean, that's a compliment to New Hampshire, at least.
Not the kind of compliment you want, but still, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, David Finkelhor, what do you think? This magnet issue, if New Hampshire's laws regarding sex offenders are too lax, people getting out of prison will say, hey, let's go to the Granite State.
Well, let me just talk about the residency restriction issue first. I mean, it's good that we're talking about sex offenders, and it's completely understandable why people would like not to have sex offenders in their community. But the residency restrictions are one aspect of sex offender management policy that have not been shown to be effective. There have been studies in Florida and Minnesota and Iowa that have not shown that the communities are protected by these laws. And I think they're based on a bad logic. What we know about sex offenders, they mostly meet their victims through their social networks, through the families they belong to, through friends that they have. It's rarely that they encounter someone simply in their neighborhood. And so the steps that we need to take to protect children really involve work in those family environments, those schools and youth serving environments, not really restricting where they live.
So these are aimed at the image people have, David, of a spooky stranger hanging around a playground instead of someone known to the child, an uncle or a coach or mom or dad's boyfriend or girlfriend when there's been a divorce in the family. That's where sex offenses tend to occur, not the spooky stranger at the playground. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. And another problem is that 90% of new sex offenses are committed by someone who has no prior history. So we could keep them all, or think we're keeping all of them out of the state, but we'd be ignoring the 90% who aren't on our radar yet. And I think it tends to let people let their guard down. It's much better to use the presence of sex offenders in the community as an opportunity to get parents and other youth-serving organizations to educate families and children about how to protect themselves.
Well, and Jill Rocky, how do groups like yours that represent victims of sex crimes feel about these residency requirements?
So we are concerned about anything that makes victims safer. And the rep said two things. One, I do understand what she's saying about the residency restrictions. We have found, like Dr. Finkelhor has, that they're not effective. They do not make our citizens safer. What they do is cause sex offenders to go underground, and it increases the unregistered sex offender rate astronomically. And we feel that victims are safer when you know where they are. However, she also brought up the fact that there are websites and sex offenders do talk, and they do compare states. And New Hampshire has been a destination state in the past.
Really?
Absolutely. And it's something that law enforcement, prosecutors, legislators do review time to time. And it is something that could be reviewed again, because you have states registering people for different reasons. Our state is based on conviction. So you only have to register what you were convicted of, where if you go down to the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, once you're convicted, you go through an entire evaluation process, and that's how you're put on the tiered system. Completely different than New Hampshire. So that's just one example of how people may move back and forth between the southern part of the state based on what they're classified in Massachusetts as opposed to New Hampshire. So I do think that was a very important point she made about sex offenders looking for places to live.
So the registry, it sounds like you're saying, Jill, could be improved.
Oh, I think any system could be improved, but definitely I think how we evaluate them could be looked at and reconsidered.
Okay, definitely want to follow up with you and others on that. But let me also invite our listeners to join us. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Join us. We're looking at what our policies should be here in New Hampshire towards sex offenders. once they're released from prison. We've been talking about residency requirements that have been struck down in a couple towns here in New Hampshire, but also we'll be looking at the registry here in the Granite State and how it might compare to other states. Join us with your questions and comments about this tough topic today in The Exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And Representative Prudhomme O'Brien, I want to bring you back in, please. The idea, and I've heard this from a couple different groups, a couple different types of people, that they're concerned that the residency restrictions drive sex offenders underground. They don't want to be restricted as to where they live, and so they just try to skirt the registry, or they find they can't find a place to live, so they end up, you know, homeless or living under a bridge and so forth. What do you think about that, Representative Prudhomme O'Brien?
I think the social stigma of being a sex offender itself helps to drive these people underground. I mean, what do you want to change that? I don't agree with that, of course. I think that these are people that they're probably among the most manipulative and conniving people that you will ever meet. That's how they get away with their crimes for as long as they do. And if they're not going to obey the law, they're not going to obey the law. Why make it easier for them? I don't know what to tell you. If people choose to not obey the law, that's on them.
What do you think would be the best approach, Representative, once these folks are released from prison? Or maybe they should have longer prison sentences. Maybe that's the solution. What do you think? I'm curious.
I think that might be something the longer prison sentences are something that people might continue to think about if we don't allow communities to do these sorts of things. I like what Ms. Rockne was talking about, the graduated levels, that we could do more in New Hampshire to assess that.
David Finkelhor told us 90% of sex offenders have no prior record. So, you know, that's most of them. How do we approach that?
Thank you for bringing that up. That brings me to some ex post facto punishments issues. Now, as I think about that, and that's going to be something you'll probably hear about in the rest of this hour, I think about things like, if you're convicted of domestic violence or even accused of it, you cannot have a gun, even if that gun was legally purchased long before that crime occurred. Now, how many of those people have no prior record? It's probably pretty high also. So that's my feeling on that.
Okay. Well, Representative Prudhomme O'Brien, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
That's Catherine Prudhomme O'Brien. She's a first-term Republican state representative from Derry. A lot more to follow up on after a short break. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking once again at policy towards sex offenders here in New Hampshire and comparing to other states. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Our guests for the hour are David Finkelhor, director of the Crimes Against Children Research Center and a professor of sociology at UNH. Also with us, Jill Rocky, executive director at the Crisis Center of Central New Hampshire and a former detective sergeant with the New Hampshire State Police. Join us again at 1-800-892-6477. Your questions and comments are welcome on this issue. And Jill Rocky, I can see you wanted to jump in just before the break. We were finishing up with Representative Prudhomme O'Brien, who was calling for, you know, tough restrictions on this population.
And she talked about the stat that Dr. Finkelhor had brought up, the 90% no prior history. And I believe, and please correct me if I'm wrong, Dr. Finkelhor, that is no prior criminal record.
That's right.
Okay. And so one of the most important things about sex offender treatment is when you get them into the system, the sex offender treatment program, I'm not sure if people are aware of this, at the New Hampshire State Prison, when you go in, you have to talk about every sexual offense you ever committed, not just the one you were convicted of. And they actually do polygraphs with offenders to make sure that they're talking about every offense they've been convicted of. And then they work off of that. And sex offender management has to have a strong component of sex offender treatment. However, there's not really a lot of regulation with sex offender treatment providers. So as an example, Dr. Scott Hampton, who works out of the Seacoast area, he's a nationally recognized sex offender treatment, and he runs a batterers intervention program. The accountability piece is huge. And
admitting what you did was wrong.
Absolutely. And admitting what you did to every victim that you had.
And not just that he or she acted like he or she wanted it or whatever. None of those excuses.
Correct. And so when we're talking about sex offender management, rather than looking at where they're living, you know, really being able to evaluate what kind of predator they are. Do they have multiple victims? Were they children, women? Were they anybody? Those are important factors in and the acknowledgement. So I just wanted to talk about that because she had brought that up at the end.
Yeah, well, and it brings up a question that I had as well. For you, David Finkelhor, some of these laws, it seems to me, reflect a feeling that many sex offenders are not treatable, are not able to be rehabilitated, that if you let them out or don't watch them every second of the day, they will reoffend. What do we know about that, given your research?
Well, there's a tremendous spectrum of dangerousness in the sex offender population. It's quite varied. I don't think the representative's characterization of them as all kind of insidious, manipulative is true. You know, like about 30% of sex crimes are committed by juveniles, and we know they're very rehabilitatable. And there are good assessment tools right now for figuring out who the most serious and dangerous are. They're not foolproof, but we do have a pretty we can make some discrimination among them. And I think that what we need to do is make sure that we've assessed people, put the ones who have the most likelihood of reoffend in prison for lengthy sentences, but others can be treated fairly safely in the community without incurring the cost of having to incarcerate them.
Let's take a call, all of you. And again, our number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And in Farmington, Wanda's on the line. Hi, Wanda. Go ahead.
Hi. So if the representative restrictions don't work, what does work? How do we stop it from happening?
Yeah, it's a great question, Wanda, and one we're trying to dig into. I'd love to hear from both of you on this. Why don't you go first, Jill? If she's saying, okay, you guys have said residency restrictions don't work, what does?
So I think what Dr. Finkelhor just said, there are great assessment ways of assessing sex offenders out there that we could be using in our state to kind of categorize them, not as we're categorizing them now, by what they were convicted of. And we all know the conviction process, you know, between plea agreements and victims not being able to testify, what somebody actually did and what they were convicted of can vary greatly. But these assessment programs, and again, I'll use Massachusetts as an example, and I'm not familiar with their assessment program, but they look at everything. The offender is evaluated, and that's how they decide the dangerous and possible recidivism of that offender. And that's a much better way of assessing them than the way we currently do it, because it's solely focused on how dangerous the offender is.
These are assessments, though, Jill, right, of people who are already convicted. It doesn't get at those people who haven't done anything yet.
Correct. But it also looks at, it's not just looking at what they were convicted of. It's looking at any offense they ever committed. That's the whole, everything can come in from arrest reports to psychologist evaluations.
So a more holistic assessment, a broader assessment. I can hear you want to jump in, David. Go ahead. Yeah.
My view is we need a three-pronged approach here. The first prong of it is to have a good prevention education for young people and parents and people who work in youth-serving organizations and schools so that kids don't get victimized, and parents have better ways of supervising them so they don't get victimized. Then we need strong investigative resources in law enforcement, because when cases get discovered and people get arrested, that's one of the best ways to stop offending from occurring. And then the third prong is we need good, intensively supervised sex offender management programs of the kind that Jill's been talking about.
Management meaning once they get out of prison, David?
Right, because they inevitably do. And so there needs to be ways of making sure that they don't reoffend by, having people keep an eye on them, making sure that they're integrated into the community in ways that keep them from descending into their old patterns of behavior. The good news is that recidivism rates have been coming down due to the kinds of programs that we've been implementing, and overall sex offending has dropped quite a bit. It's down, sexual abuse is down about 62% in the United States since 1992, and rape is also down by a similar amount.
Again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Here's an email that came in from Jean in Exeter. She says, how very interesting that we have sex offender registries and want to know where these offenders live. Yet, Jean says, we don't think we should know where people convicted of drunk driving or habitual driving offenders live. And those are the people who injure and kill New Hampshire residents. I would sure like to see a list of people in my neighborhood that might be aiming their car at me while driving under the influence of drugs or alcohol, or maybe just the ones who are habitually texting while driving. Jean says, it seems we are feeling like we can be, quote, safe if we can just intern this one population. We don't track released murderers, bank robbers, any other former felons. What do you think, Jill Rocky? Is there sort of a unfair tracking of these people once they're released from prison?
So I think that, you know, this all stemmed from a little girl named Megan Kenka. And it was because she lived across the street from a sex offender that had gotten out. And I apologize, his name escapes me right now. But she was sexually assaulted and murdered by this a registered offender. And that is what spawned this, that parents and the law enforcement, the public, were very angry about this. And please understand, I don't have all the answers, but I do think that anybody that's ever worked with a sexual assault victim, whether it was a child or an adult or an elderly person, male or female, these crimes are devastating to them. Not that a drunk driving accident isn't, but it goes with them throughout their life. And I think that the importance of having people know where offenders are, and again, I'm going back to what Dr. Finkelhor was talking about, knowing where the really dangerous offenders are is a great way to deal with this issue, looking at how we're evaluating them. And I can tell you from a law enforcement perspective, they would much rather be keeping track of the dangerous offenders rather than all offenders.
Does the registry make that distinction that this is a dangerous sex offender and this one is a 19-year-old boy who had sex with his 15-year-old girlfriend?
So no, because it's based on conviction. However, when and anecdotally, I can think of a time where I got a call from the prison. I was running in the registry at the time, and she told me that Mr. X was getting out, that he had maxed out on his time, which told me he hadn't participated in sex offender treatment, and he had several prior convictions, several victims. So that's somebody I would be concerned about, as opposed to somebody who was 19. And I think that there is no Romeo and Juliet registering. There is no Romeo
boyfriend,
and Juliet.
Girlfriend.
And
yeah.
That's a misconception. It is. And when I'm at the state house and I hear people testifying, it's always the same, that the girl was 14 or 15 and they were, you know, together in high school. And then when you pull the police report, they were 40. So it's a common misconception that we make people register. If it's 4 years or more, then yes. And the child is under 16. The age of consent in New Hampshire is 16, but we don't have Romeo Juliets on the registry.
Again, our number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Claire is joining us from Hollis. Hi, Claire. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a different take on the whole thing. I was molested twice, once when I was 10 by someone I knew, and once when I was 20 by someone I didn't know but was frequently in a building that I was in. And I feel very strongly that if someone is convicted and they are a serious threat to society, and you're able to evaluate that, which I've heard your guests say that you can, that they should never be allowed to be free, that they are sick, there is no treatment for a certain group, and that they need to, I don't know whether or not you create a place that they live, but they should not be back in society, period. And that if they have served their time, then why shouldn't they be treated like a burglar or a murderer or anyone else if they are then free to come out and, you know, live their life? I don't agree with the registry. I think that there is a certain percentage of these people that need to be totally removed, and I think that you are doing them a great disservice, because if they serve their term, they should be allowed to be totally free, and if the government or whoever it is wants to make sure that they are not, they do not reoffend, then they need to be removed from society, because that is the only treatment that will work for them.
So, I'm really interested in your story, Claire, and I'm very, very sorry to hear what happened to you. That's something that nobody should have to go through.
Yep.
I'm kind of hearing two things from you, though, so I want to ask you a little bit more. You started off by saying there's no treatment, you shouldn't let these folks out, but then you went on to say, you know, once they've served their time, they should be like a burglar or anybody else and not
be
registered. I'm not really sure where you're going with that.
What I'm saying is that the person, I think the doctor said, or the woman that is your guest said, that they are able to evaluate sex offenders. And there are different categories of how dangerous they are. And if they are in the untreatable, most dangerous area category, that those people need to be removed from society.
So keep them
but
in.
All other sex offenders, that is the Romeo and Juliet, the, you know, whatever else, you know, however else you categorize them, then they deserve to not be on a registry.
Sort of tagged for life.
I think it's terrible.
All right.
I think it's really terrible. If you've got a disease, if you had Ebola, the government was going to take you out and not allow you to go on a plane or, you know, go to church or whatever you wanted to do. You're not allowed to because you were a threat to the country. And I believe that the severe, offenders are in the same category as an Ebola. They cannot help themselves. They need to be removed.
Well, Claire, thank you so much for calling in and giving us your perspective, again, given what happened to you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Again, our number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Joining us now for a few minutes is Chris Dornan, founder and chairman of public relations for Citizens for Criminal Justice Reform. And Chris Dornan, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it.
It's a privilege. Thank you.
Well, we talked earlier about these residency requirements. You helped craft the bill that would have banned towns from imposing these residency requirements. But as we said earlier, this bill was tabled by the full House. But almost, I think there's just one town, Chris, in New Hampshire that even has these residency requirements. So why was it necessary to ban them, given that they barely exist?
Marvelous question. Tilton last weekend or the weekend before repealed their residency restriction under pressure of the possible lawsuit. The vote was 35-3, and Holderness is the last one left. They have no intention of getting rid of their residency restriction. The head of the selectmen told me that I want to see it struck down or repealed, that I should prevail on their police chief to educate their voters.
But if there's only one town in the whole state that has one of these, why bother with this law?
Because...
Or with this bill, excuse me.
The larger issue is organized vigilantism by communities. They know it's unconstitutional. The police chief knows it's unconstitutional. And if the local level is not going to police itself, are we going to tolerate throwing out the rule of law in New Hampshire? If it is disrespected anywhere, then the whole cloth is ruptured.
We heard earlier from State Representative Prudhomme O'Brien. She voted against the bill that you helped craft, as you heard. And she said New Hampshire has become, and this was confirmed by Jill Rocky, has become somewhat of a magnet for sex offenders because of our relatively easy laws, if I could put it that way. What do you think?
Well, compared to Florida, which zones them to the Everglades and makes them wear global positioning devices so that if they inadvertently go too near a school or park, they might get busted. In Georgia, which zones them away from living near a school bus stop, yes, against that competition, we look like an attractive place.
So you're saying that's the other states, some other states take extreme measures against this group of people.
If an unconstitutional terror is taken, panic is taking over some of the larger states in this country, I think New Hampshire has to do what it thinks is right and give us laws that have integrity. And if that drives people here, I personally don't think that would be a terribly bad thing. They ought to have haven somewhere.
One last quick question for you, Chris, and I appreciate you joining us. I know you're against the residency requirements, as we discussed. What about the registries? Is that okay in your book?
There was a Supreme Court decision a few weeks ago in John Doe versus New Hampshire, which declared the registry an unconstitutional retroactive punishment for one man who was convicted in 1982. Our group filed an amicus brief on behalf of John Doe, and we're raising money for a class action lawsuit that would blow it to smithereens.
All right. Well, it sounds like that's a topic for a whole other show then, the registries. We've talked a lot about the residency requirements. Chris Dornan, thank you very much for joining us. We appreciate it. That's Chris Dornan, founder and chairman of Public Relations for Citizens for Criminal Justice Reform. More in a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're talking about laws and policies relating to sex offenders here in New Hampshire and around the country. What should they look like? How should we deal with this population of people once they're released from prison? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And David Finkelhor, Jill Rocky, before we go back to our listeners, David, I did want to talk to you a little bit more about the registries, which Chris Dornan mentioned in his brief segment. We've talked a lot about the residency requirements, your thoughts on why they don't work, how different states and towns have dealt with them. What about the registries, David? Are they a useful tool or not?
Well, registries were originally set up in order to help law enforcement when they were trying to solve crimes, so they would know if there were people with a criminal history in the area. And I think for that purpose, they're quite useful. But what's happened more recently is they've been, made public, and they, become searchable. To the extent that they tell members of the community that they need to provide information to their kids and supervise them well, I think that that's useful. But they also have downsides in the sense that they do, as Chris said, sometimes result in vigilante action towards sex offenders. And law enforcement have complained to some extent that the notification laws that require them to go around and tell people about the existence of sex offenders in their neighborhood in some places aren't a really good usage of their time. And I think I agree with that. The research on the registries has not shown that they reduce sex offending, unfortunately.
So knowing who these people are doesn't reduce the amount of sex crimes, especially against children?
Yes, to the extent they've been evaluated. I'd like to address one issue, which I'm afraid a couple of the comments may have left people with the impression that New Hampshire is becoming a destination for a lot of sex offenders. And although we may not have laws that are as draconian as other places, I think the idea that there are large numbers of sex offenders who are deciding to settle in New Hampshire simply on the basis of that is really wrong. I mean, sex offenders settle in places where they, you know, have resources, where they have family and people who can help them out. And I think few of them are just picking up and coming to New Hampshire because of the legal situation.
You know, Jill, love your thoughts on this, too. And then we'll go back to our listeners. I know a lot of parents who, when they move into a neighborhood, they check the sex offender registry list to see if there's anybody living nearby. I think some states even have an app that updates the status of where sex offenders are living, so you can get it on your phone and check on it. What's the impact, do you think, Jill, of having this information so readily available?
So just going off of what Dr. Finkelor just said, I don't think, again, that New Hampshire is necessarily a magnet, but I do think that people, if they have family in Massachusetts and they're going to be a higher tier in Mass, may move to New Hampshire to avoid, you know, dealing with all the things that they would have to deal with in Mass.
So maybe not people flocking here from Georgia or Florida.
No, I don't think they're flocking here, but I do think those small jumps from one state to the other on the border does happen. But as far – and really quickly, Claire had brought something up. There's a three strikes, you're out law in New Hampshire.
So this is the woman who called who'd been victimized twice.
Yes. Yeah. And so I wanted to let her know that we do have a law in New Hampshire where if you have three separate convictions, the third time you're convicted, you do get life. So that is something. Unfortunately, you have to get to that three conviction point. But once you do, then you are locked up for life. So we do have sex offenders that are locked up for life. So going back to your question.
Yeah, the registries. I mean, would you advise, let's say a friend of yours has two kids and, you know, she just moved into a new neighborhood. Would you advise her to check the sex offender registry in her new neighborhood?
So you and I talked earlier about how we both are still 29. But when I started at the sex offender registry back in 1999, that was the first time New Hampshire had a public list. And computers weren't what they were today. People were not on the internet looking these lists up. As Dr. Finkelhor said, this was mainly for law enforcement. But once the Megan's Law passed in New Hampshire, now we made these lists available to the public. And you did that by printing it out every month. And people could go to their local police department to look at it. So it's a very proactive thing.
You had to really, you know, make time and effort to do this.
Absolutely. And once the internet and now everybody has a computer and a smartphone, you know, that list has been available online for quite a few years. And I think it's important to understand that the public list is different from the registry. Not everybody that is registered as a sex offender is on the public list.
So really?
The public is not seeing everybody, no.
So what good is it?
I think it is good tool for people to be able to look up who's in their neighborhood. I know a lot of schools and volunteer groups will go on the registry and look in case they have a new volunteer. You know, obviously it's not used to do criminal background checks. People can do criminal record checks for that. But I think having access to it right now is very useful. It's publicly we've seen that people want to have access to the registry. Again, going back to what we were discussing earlier, could we make it better? Could we just have the people that are a danger to the public at the highest degree on the public list? You know, I think that's a conversation that we need to gear up for. And Dr. Finkelhor was right. This list is not going to prevent sexual assault or child sexual assault in our state. Prevention. He said three tiers, and he's absolutely right.
Educating kids.
Educating kids, parents. Getting them at a point where, you know, you can make a real difference. There is not a lot of funding. You know, I'm part of the New Hampshire Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. We have 13 programs. We do prevention work when we have funding, and there's very little funding for prevention work. The investigation piece, he's absolutely correct about that. And not just the investigation, but the number of prosecutions that actually happen in reporting sexual assault cases. So I think the when he was talking about sex offender management, he's correct. You know, we really have to look at other states and other Canada as an example. I hope Dr. Finkelor speaks about that. But there are some really good forward-thinking places now that are really managing offenders, whereas we're really not. We're taking people based on their conviction and putting them on a registry, and that's not really managing them.
All right. Well, I know you want to talk about that, David Finkelhor. Lots of calls, too, though, so let's jump back into those for just a moment. And Christine, joining up from Merrimack. Go ahead, Christine. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I appreciated having the registry. I raised three boys in the neighborhood where there was a sex offender, one on each part of the of our neighborhood. So as a mother and a parent, I appreciated knowing that they were there, but also I felt like it really tied my kids' freedom as they got older. There were hiking trails that they could not take advantage of. They had to always check back home more often. But at the same time, my husband and I moved to New Hampshire purposely to raise our children here because the crime rate was so low. Yet, who do we want a magnet of families coming to New Hampshire, or do we want a magnet of sex offenders?
So it changed the way you parented those boys, Christine.
Yes. And I purposely, you know, I did do a little daycare also out of my home for friends, a small daycare. And it worried me having two sex offenders on either end of my neighborhood.
What about the idea that David Finkelhor told us earlier that the vast, vast, vast majority of sex offenses aren't the stranger who lives down the street? It's the uncle, or it's the, you know, the coach or whatever. What do you think about that? Maybe you shouldn't have worried about those people in your neighborhood. That's what that indicates anyway.
Well, if it was a relative, the uncle or this or that, you would know that they are a sex offender. Maybe not the first time they did it, but at least you would have that information. I appreciated having that registry. Also, for those that do volunteer, whether it's Cub Scouts or Girl Scouts, if they're going up to people's homes to sell candles for the schools or whatever, we want to know that they're safe to go to these places.
Okay. Christine, it's great to hear from you. And it does raise a question I wanted to ask you, David Finkelhor. I've heard this from other parents. These registries changing the way people parent and maybe not letting their kids go so far afield because they're worried.
There is a good side to it in the sense that it does remind people that they have to educate their kids about it. But it may create some false sense of security, and it may prompt them to do things that are less effective if they're exclusively focused on the stranger danger and the sex offender in the neighborhood. This is one of the hardest things, not just with regard to sexual abuse, but with regard to violence as well. You know, the people who are most likely to kill a kid or seriously injure a kid are relatives and peers and people that they know. And so being thoughtful about how they are in their close social networks, knowing what the signs are of somebody who poses a danger, those are more important, I think, than kind of restricting them from freedom around the neighborhood or even going out and, you know, the woods or the fields.
Well, it's easy to understand the fear, though, that she raises. I mean, any parent, you know, doesn't want anybody to do anything to their child. If you were Christine, David Finkelhor, living where she lived, knowing that there were these sex offenders right around the corner, would you have let your kids wander in the woods?
Yes, I think I would have. And the key thing is to talk to them starting at a young age about the kinds of inappropriate things that adults can do, and to refuse those kinds of ploys that adults might use to get kids involved in such activities, to encourage them to tell, to talk about people who are behaving in ways that give them a feeling that something isn't right, and to sort of get away from them. These are the kinds of skills that kids need in order to stay safe.
All right, let's take another call. And Christine, great to hear from you. Let's go to Keene. Barbara's on the air. Go ahead, Barbara.
Yes, I think it's important to remember or to know that many child sexual abusers were themselves abused as children and never received treatment for this.
What do you know anything about that, either David Finkelhor or Jill? Jill, is that up your alley?
Anecdotally, and I'm sure Dr. Finkelhor can answer this better than I, but not getting treatment. There are a lot of children that are sexually abused that never become offenders, and it has nothing to do with that necessarily. It just has to do with the fact that they have that in themselves to go on to become an offender. I am all for people getting treatment, but I think it does a disservice to the victims that never grow up to be offenders to say if you got treatment, then you would have. Because a lot of kids don't report that they were sexually assaulted. But I'd be curious to hear what Dr. Finkelhor has to say on that.
Yeah,
as
go ahead, David. Yeah.
Well, certainly it can be one component in what brings somebody to commit a sex offense, but it's not the only one, and not all offenders have themselves been molested. Generally, there has been a history of maltreatment or neglect or deprivation. There are problems in their development that make it more difficult for them to control their behavior, and oftentimes there's substance abuse that is an attempt to deal with, you know, other kinds of problems that they've had in their lives. So, yeah, they are a population that has faced adversities, and certainly one of the things that we do in managing the population is to give them the skills and help them get treatment for the adversities that continue to make it hard for them to control their behavior. But that's not the only thing.
Let's take one more. This is Kimberly in Concord. Thank you, Barbara, for that call. Kimberly, go ahead. You're on the exchange.
Hi there. Good morning.
Morning.
I just wanted to say really quick that I feel like in a topic as important as this shouldn't devolve into being more concerned about the rights of perpetrators than the rights of children and people to be safe and to live their lives. Just like that lady, Christine, was talking about, there should be social sanctions against this kind of stuff. And that's pretty much what I wanted to say, but thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you very much. And, you know, again, here we have someone saying, look, you know, don't be so concerned about the people who perpetrate these crimes. What about the victims? What about feeling safe? You do hear frustration from parents that they look at this list and they just don't feel like it's right that these people are there and they feel threatened.
So I want to go.
One problem is that, you know, we see stories in the newspaper every day about sex crimes and on the one hand, it's good because it shows the attention that we're paying to the problem, and it is an opportunity to alert people that this is something that they need to be on the lookout for. But it does create the impression that we are just living in a complete epidemic. And in fact, law enforcement and I think the prevention effort has been succeeding to some degree. As I mentioned earlier, the crime rate and the sex crime rate and the child molestation rate have been coming down, which I think is a testimony to the effectiveness of policy. To some extent, these residency restriction efforts are a response to people who feel like not enough is being done to protect their kids. And I think we could do a better job of publicizing just how much, in fact, is being done. Law enforcement is much, much more active in this area than they were a generation ago. They have many new techniques, including using high-tech investigatory tools to find people who are molesting children. And I believe that children are much safer than they were before, but that the public hasn't become aware of it.
Go ahead, Jill, you want to jump in there?
I just wanted to say to Kimberly that the whole reason that I'm here today is because as victim services, we are very concerned about sex offenders and how they are treated in society from a victim perspective. I'd like to remind, going back to what Christine said, Nathaniel Kibbe was a case that occurred in New Hampshire. It was a stranger case. So we are a safe state, but everybody should be cautious with their children. And I think that you did what was appropriate for your family to keep your kids safe. They're not unusual cases. You know, I can think back
all the way to Stranger Danger cases.
Tammy Belanger. You know, we've had Rachel Garden. There have been several young women that have disappeared in our state. So they do happen. And I think it's appropriate for parents to keep their children safe.
Absolutely. Well, thank you, Christine, for the call. Kimberly, everyone else who called. And thank you both for being with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.